know, dear America, I have tolerated and I have suffered over the course of this year doing this podcast with these individuals that are going to be appearing on it tonight. And, you know, I want you to know that I do it for you, dear listener, to provide you with the banter and the smart aleckness and the wise comments that you've come to expect out of PCU. But I will not take or permit any shenanigans over the next, you know, 20 to 30 minutes as I reveal what was actually the top three greatest things in pop culture this year. You've heard some vague references to things by Bell and Pete. I got the real heat. So, Bell, Pete, good evening. How are you?
Wow.
Seriously. Yeah, like, man. All right, I'm going to just let you live your life.
All right, so what's your top three? Let's just get it out of the way.
Yeah, oh, so, right. now it's just get it out the way.
Yeah, right.
Just hurry up and finish, huh, Pete? All right, well, look. So, first things first, we have done a whole episode on this where we deep dived into it, and so I don't want to go into a whole lot of spoilers or anything else. I just want to say the creator was one of two projects that surpassed every expectation I had. The other was Loki, which we've already discussed. But you should definitely check out Bell's breakdown. Bell had a phenomenal breakdown of Loki as a character in the show and the season. So definitely check that out. Not casting any shade on Loki at all, which I thought was exceptional. But the other project was The Creator, which if I had to offer the most basic synopsis, what Blade Runner could have been if it had a soul is what The Creator really is. I'm not going to act as if it was the world's most original idea, right? I mean, it is lone wolf and cub with robots on a globe-trotting, including space adventure, with functionally a father and his child. But when you go through the larger themes and you kind of go through how there are all these wonderful, very smart references to American imperialism and how the West tries to impose its worldview on the rest of the world. In this instance, specifically in relationship to AI, where the rest of the world has accepted the existence of AI and AI is living cooperatively with those humans, but the West believes that there was an AI who was responsible for a nuclear attack on Los Angeles, so it's dedicated to wiping off AI all over the planet. And in the midst of all that, we have John David Washington's character, who I did not see him in Black Klansman, although people told me I should have watched it. And after watching The Creator, I'm like, I missed out on something good, and I got to backtrack and catch him in that, and I got to make time to watch him in Tenet. Because the performance that he plays in this movie, I don't want to insult him by saying that he's got some of his father in him, because his mother is just as talented as his father is. So I will say, you can see his parents in his performance. His performance was phenomenal. There's nothing more I could have asked for and I can say this genuinely, you know, it was a movie that really resonated with me on an emotional level. Some of the best uses of CGI, because it didn't go over the top and use a ton of it. CGI that was used really effectively when they used it. The rest of the time, it was straight up, just acting. And it was funny in ways that you wouldn't expect it to be, that gave the movie a charm and a beauty to it. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it's a hard sci-fi ending. It is not and they walked off, you know, into the woods in sunset, to use the infamous Blade Runner ending where they go north into the woods, where they actually use cut footage from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining because they couldn't figure out another way to give the movie a happy ending. Instead of trying to give an artificial ending, they give you a hard sci-fi ending that feels emotionally right. So, Creator, without a doubt, my number one pick.
That
Bell.
Was,
Pete, go ahead.
Oh, just that, you know, that movie, it was just surprising, like how good it was at telling a story we've all seen. There weren't a lot of surprises, but it failed to trip up the way some of our favorite movies that follow that type of storyline do trip up. And this was just like, yeah, I think it all they wanted to do was tell a complete story from beginning to end, and ignoring things like, well, how could we write this so that it would have sequel potential? How could we write that? Like, it was just like, no, this is the story you're getting. And we meet all of these broken people in the middle of the end of their journeys. So many of them, and it's just, yeah, that's why.
That was the one time I was right all this year. Belle, go ahead.
No, basically, all I was going to say is that I 100% agree with Pete. That movie had me all kinds of messed up. And that's all I got to say about that. I'm like, this was the year of Belle's feelings being deeply hurt by film and television. Because, yeah.
I'll just say in conclusion, I know that The Creator was not a major box office success. I will tell you that my prediction is that it's going to go on to be a cult film. Which is actually fitting when you look at Blade Runner. It's always been stunning that there was ever a sequel, because that movie was about as troubled and kind of like people loved it but didn't like it because they were expecting Han Solo and they got Deckard, which was very different than what they were expecting. But no, I mean, I thought The Creator, to Pete's point, it may not have been the most original idea, but it was probably the best executed thing that I saw other than Loki this year. So that's my one. For number two, you know, I like graphic novels. I like graphic novels a lot. As a matter of fact, I love historical graphic novels more than anything else. Particularly ones dealing with African-Americans, which I'm sure you're going to say is like, oh, well, Armand, that's what I expect because you're Black. I'll just offer this. When I was a child going to school and I asked in the third grade, when exactly was it that I was going to learn anything about my people, seeing how I had learned about the French and the British, I was told that my people had never done anything of historical note worth recording before we were enslaved. And before anybody thinks I was educated in the Deep South, I went to school in Massachusetts. So I have spent my entire adult life learning all the Black history that I should have known as a child, which is ironic when your child now comes home and he's like, Dad, we're learning about Queen Nzinga in school. And he's in the fourth grade. And you're like, yeah, I heard about Queen Nzinga when I bought the book on her 3 years ago, because I was a grown man and knew something that you now know as a 9-year-old. Yay for Dad. Join me next week when I watch a movie on VHS. So I said all that to say that one of my favorite things for this year was Last on His Feet, Jack Johnson and the Battle of the Century. For anybody who does not know, Jack Johnson is probably one of the most significant African-American, you know, historical figures in the 20th century. He is the first Black heavyweight champion, wins it in 1908. By the way, is the subject of an amazing book by Jeffrey Ward called Unforgivable Blackness, which is also the name of the Ken Burns documentary. I am not like a Ken Burns, you know, super fan, but I will just say that was extraordinarily well made. This is even better. So every now and then in life, you get just unique artistic collaborations that bring out so much. So really starts as a book of poetry. It was called The Big Smoke, which was one of Jack Johnson's nicknames. And it was written by the guy who would go on to do to write the dialogue for Last on His Feet, Adrian Matajika. Now, the artwork was done by Yusuf Dayoudi. And one, this is a phenomenally gorgeous book that is very honest about who Jack Johnson is. Jack Johnson is not, he was not a quote-unquote race man. In other words, he didn't stand for Black folks and say, oh, I'm fighting for Black folks and for freedom. No, Jack Johnson fought for himself. The irony is that sometimes history uses you whether you want to or not. And so Jack Johnson, whether he likes it or not, he's the first Black heavyweight champion back when being the heavyweight champion, I've heard it described as being the emperor of masculinity. And it was intolerable that he held the belt, which is where we get the term the Great White Hope. The Great White Hope was Jim Jeffries, who was the former champion who had retired, who white America believed without a doubt that there was absolutely no way that that Jack Johnson could beat him. And then Jack Johnson did what everybody thought was the impossible in a ring in Reno, Nevada. Thank you. Now that my tongue's untied. He fights in front of an all-white audience during a time period where Black men were getting lynched and castrated and set on fire. He's fighting the Great White Hope. And he beats Jim Jeffries so bad that by the middle of the fight, he's picking him up off the mat before he falls down. He's like, oh, no, can't fall down now, Mr. Jeff. been waiting too long for this fight. But Jack Johnson is also a womanizer. He also hates black women. The myth is that he was cheated on once by one black woman after he had quote unquote had made it. And after that, never again was Jack Johnson ever seen with a black woman, which for the time period was a source of huge consternation, not just for the white community, but for the black community as well, who thought it was embarrassing that the first black champion couldn't at least have a black woman in a black family. But this is also a man who, this is probably the only boxer who holds a patent at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, because he so loved racing cars, he built his own specialized wrench to work on them, which I'll conclude my whole, glowing review of Last on His Feet by saying there's a wonderful Jack Johnson story where he's driving through some small town in the South and the cop pulls him over. This is when cars are still new. He goes, "Boy, you can't be driving fast through here like this. That's going to cost you." He's like, "How much?" He's like, $50. Because, of course, back then when you could buy an apple for a nickel, $50 was a whole hell of a lot of money. So Jack Johnson pulls out a huge roll of money and peels off a $100 bill. And the cop looks at him and goes, I can't break change. What am I going to do with this? And Jack Johnson says, "No, I want you to keep it because I'm coming back through the same way that I went out." That's Jack Johnson. The Bell knows I am a big devotee of Dr. Greg Carr, who teaches at Howard University, African American Studies. One of my favorite sayings by Dr. Carr is the fact that sometimes in history, there are no good guys and bad guys. They're just people. Jack Johnson is just a person, as flawed and broken. So the same way we can sit and praise George Washington and be like, he was the first president. He ensured the peaceful transfer of power. Absolutely. He deserves all that. He was also the biggest slave owner and the biggest landowner at the time as well. And by the way, his teeth were not wooden. They were taking out the mouths of enslaved Africans. So we can praise George Washington for the good things that he did. Jack Johnson is another historical figure where he should not be lionized or canonized, but he does deserve to be remembered for who he was and what he was doing during a pivotal time in American history. So that's Last on His Feet. If you're interested in a super deep dive, we covered it earlier this year on the Black Excellence Book Club. We'll have a link in the description to that episode. Seeing how I know neither one of you have read the book, I won't bother you for your opinion of something that you haven't read.
Well, I want to, so you did your job, right?
You did what we asked of you. But so I do have a question. So is the book arranged as like a collection of stories, or is it sort of chronologically told, and these are just things that happen throughout his life as we follow it from when we start to finish?
They bounce around. I mean, the battle of the century, the battle with the Great White Hope, Jim Jeffries, is the central organizing piece of the whole book. So I would say that is its core, and everything else spins around it. So it's not a book that's told in pure chronological order. I will say, having read all of Unforgivable Blackness and Adrian Matajikas, who's an amazing poet, by the way, and I say this as somebody, I don't typically read poetry, and his poetry in The Big Smoke was, as soon as I saw that he did this, I was like, oh, I've read The Big Smoke. I don't like poetry, and I love that book. So there ain't no way in hell I'm not getting my hands on this. So not told in perfect chronological order, but it is a great summation of Jack Johnson's life. If you want the full details, you got to check out Unforgivable Blackness. But for somebody who doesn't know anything about Jack Johnson, you can read Last on His Feet and have a really good understanding of who Jack Johnson was as a person. And I will just say, Yusuf Daoudi's artwork is phenomenal and is a perfect compliment. So really was one of the great, for me, it was one of the great things we reviewed on PCU this year. It's one of my favorite episodes that I ever recorded, and it's one of my favorite graphic novels I've ever covered. So I hope and pray that these two unite again for something else. But if this is the only time the two of them collaborate, this is Illmatic as a graphic novel. It's legitimately that good. That's two. I'm going to say, for the record, I was going to do an easy cop out and say The Equalizer 3, because it's Denzel Washington and it's basically a shadow sequel to Man on Fire, because they got Dakota Fanning to come back. And it's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who directed Man on Fire. So I was going to say Equalizer 3 because it's like easy. But because Pete believes that I have to be challenged so that I can produce an effective show. I decided I would try to do the impossible and convince Belle and Pete to watch an anime of which there is no manga involving a white character in Japan, which I know are things collectively that Armand would never naturally.
No, thank you.
Well, I know. I know. But I'm going to explain to you the reason why Blue-Eyed Samurai was my third favorite thing this year. All right, so look. One, I am a history buff to the Supreme Order. And I am also a political scientist long before I was a lawyer. So issues like settler colonialism, colonialism in general, Western imperialism, these are things that I studied in undergrad on a regular basis. No, don't ask me about critical race theory. They only teach that in law schools, and they didn't teach me that in law school. Probably not teaching it to your kids. But having said that, Blue-Eyed Samurai navigates all of those issues in a way that I think is unique, which is it does it through the lens of the othering of whiteness, where ordinarily it is a person of color who is the other, and we are able to look at their noble struggle. Blue-Eyed Samurai works because it touches on something that I think I've discussed in a previous podcast. Raoul Peck did a phenomenal documentary called Exterminate All the Brutes, talking about the history of settler colonialism. And one of the things that he did was to get to kind of stir up emotion in audiences was to reverse slavery, to have a sequence that was historically accurate, but instead of being enslaved Africans, it was enslaved Europeans. Because he wanted to be able to make you see, you can take the race out of this completely and say, when it comes down to people, when you see a group of people suffering, that is inherently evil. And there is no getting past that. And Blue-Eyed Samurai, in a really interesting way, does the same thing. Because what it does is they set the show in the 1600s when Japan had closed itself off to the outside world. There are four white men left in Japan. And they are like crime bosses and gun runners. They're secretly supporting the shogun. And the shogun's allowing them to live in their castles where nobody can see them. But, you know, they're all, you know, making their moves and planning. The Blue-Eyed Samurai is a young girl who, in order to get revenge, is masquerading as a man. She literally has her chest bound, and it was and there's a moment where the binding is so tight she's bleeding, but she's doing it so that she has the freedom of movement because no woman can travel on her own. And She was the product of a sexual assault. Her quest for revenge is that one of these four men sexually assaulted her mother and produced her. So for her, she's like, I am this horrible thing. And the only way I can square my life is to be able to get the revenge. Like in the trailer for the whole first season, at the end of the trailer, she's saying, I'm not expecting a happy ending. I'm not expecting a good life. I'm not expecting peace. She's like, the only thing I'm expecting is satisfaction. It is a dark story that is done phenomenally well, that has a disturbing level of representation that I just sat back and I was like, wow, this is really, if you want to try to address, you know, LGBTQA plus issues, this is a smart way of doing it. When you see how they kind of touch on how she's a woman having to masquerade as a man to be able to live the life that she needs to live, to get the justice that she needs. Ringo is an amazing character. He is a handless male cook who's basically abused by his father in the first episode. He sees our Blue-Eyed Samurai, Mizu, who, by the way, is played by Maya Erskine. You guys would have seen her. I guess she was in Maggie and Man Seeking Woman, and she was Mickey and Betas, and I guess she was on Pen 15, which was on Hulu. So, which she is gangster. Like when I say gangster, she's Denzel Washington level gangster in this. And I'm not exaggerating. If you see this first episode and you don't think like, oh, if Man on Fire happened in feudal Japan, it might feel like this, then there's something wrong with you. But Ringo meets her and he's like, look, I know what I was meant to do. I want to be a samurai. And she's like, why? And he's like, well, you're deformed, but you're strong. And and she ties him to a tree because she gets irritated as hell that he said that. But still, and it's the fact that, like, look, racial discrimination hurts because it's people devaluing your humanity to a point where you feel like you're a thing, like you're not accorded the basic level of respect and decency that any living thing, let alone a person, would expect. And so there's a moment where Mizu, played by Maya Erskine, where she's being beaten up by a group of kids, and they're basically mocking. They say, like, look, her eyes are round like a dog. So you have this white character as the outsider, as a mixed race person in a country where they can't be true to who and what they are. She's trained by a blind swordsmith played by Haruki Takagawa. So if anybody doesn't remember him, Shang Tsung from Mortal Kombat. And I will tell you, without spoiling anything, the performance between Maya Erskine and this gentleman is so fantastic that it next to the creator, it was one of the most emotionally touching things. Actually, I will spoil one part. As she's getting ready to leave to go get her revenge, she's trying to explain to him, because he's blind, that she's been lying to him, that she's really a woman. And he goes, no, he's like, you're not doing that. You came to me as a stupid, misguided, lost boy. If you're going to leave me now to seek revenge and get yourself killed, you're going to leave as a stupid, misguided old man. But I take you as who you are, as who you present and who you are in front of me. Like, you're my kid. And all this other ish, when she's like, I'm hideous. He's like, I don't have eyes. He's like, so your hideousness does not bother me. I can't see it. All I can do is feel you, hear you, live with you. So it's a great, great show with some great storytelling. Some great building. And oh, by the way, it's if you like Star Trek, George Takei is in it as well. By the way, Randall Park is too, who I love. And by the way, since Belle is a thespian, Kenneth Branagh is in it as well. So look, that's Blue Eyed Samurai. So,
all right,
I might actually watch that. Right. I wasn't planning to, because it did not sound like it was up my alley, but...
Getting a little tired, Armand. Pulling this all year.
Yeah. Armand made somewhat decent choices. Like I said, I'm shocked.
Did I mention that Mark Dacascos and Ming-Na Wen are both in it as well? Did I mention that?
No, you did not. Why didn't you? You should lead with that.
I could have, but I wanted to wait till the smart comments rolled in first, so I could be like, here are other reasons why, here are people that you love and other stuff that you should come see. But so that's my top three, which, for the record, I will say, despite all the joking, I think Bell's pick for Loki probably might be quite possibly the best actual thing of this year. So I will give her her due deference. And I will say that, you know, for based off everything I've heard, I got it. Cosign Pete's, you know, Star Trek Strange New Worlds. I have heard nothing but from diehard Trekkies and from casual fans. I have heard this was the show we should have gotten instead of Picard. So, well, I will tell you, it has been a pleasure recording this podcast for you guys. Next year, we will be going into our 15th year of doing this podcast. I have enjoyed each and every opportunity to record an episode for you guys to listen to. I hope you will support us on Patreon. I know it's hard to have a joyous and happy holiday season when you know that there are good people that are suffering. Since we're all nerds and we all know what it's like to be outcast, I hope we all take the opportunity to do something decent for somebody else. Sometimes if you can't have a happy ending for yourself, the best thing you can do is help somebody else have one. So with that note, I love you all very much. It has been an absolute pleasure recording the show. And hopefully, I'll talk to you next year. Take care. Be well.